Hey there, welcome to LSAT Demon Daily Digest. I'm Ben Olson, that's Nathan Fox. Together we're the founders of LSATdemon.com and our weekly podcast, Thinking LSAT. Here's what we talked about this week.
Ben, I wanted to know if you wanted to do an experiment here with me. This is a long email. It starts by saying, I'll preface this by saying this email might be a little bit long, but I think it's necessary. And when you say that to a couple of LSAT teachers, we use the English language literally. And I don't know. I thought that maybe we would see if we could help you find ways to cut your email.
Well, it's going to be easy because, I mean, already we can cut the first paragraph. Do you want to keep reading?
Well, I'm going to share my screen.
Okay, cool.
I don't know if that's going to make it into the recording or not, but if it is, then maybe people can just watch us live edit this.
Okay, sure.
All right, I'll start from the top and Ben will edit. Hi, Ben and Nathan. I'll preface this by saying this email might be a bit long, but I think it's necessary. Okay. My situation in LSAT prep isn't typical, and I want to know if you guys think I'm on the right track for my unique goals.
I would cut both of those sentences. One, you should make your email shorter, period. It's more likely to be read. This is just a life suggestion, right? And the second thing I would say is that if your situation actually, I don't believe that your situation isn't typical and that you're on the, you know, going on some track for your unique goals. Most people think that, and it turns out that they're not as atypical as they think. But it doesn't matter. Like, let's just jump into it. Let's jump into your atypical situation and we will judge for ourselves. This is the typical show, not tell, right? You're telling right now. Let's just show me why it's atypical and we don't need this introduction.
Yeah, I'll be the judge of whether you have unique goals. I mean, of course you do in a totally trivial sense that everyone has unique goals because we are all individuals. But when you tell me that you have unique goals, I'm just rolling my eyes like, well, okay, let's see what you have to say. Because I have a feeling you're going to say the same shit that lots of other people say. Anyway, yep. Are you cutting both those first two sentences?
These are gone. Yep.
Do it.
Done.
All right. My name's Anthony, and cut. I just started my junior year of college.
Cut. My name is Anthony. I saw that from who the email was from. I saw it from your closing. We're good.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. So far, there's been nothing in here that can't be cut.
Yeah.
I just started my junior year of college. I'm pursuing a double major in political science and history, and I'm also doing an accelerated master's program. So when I graduate in 2024, I will also have a master's degree in history.
Okay. Like, I don't know why you're giving me that background information.
Wait a second. Go change it to suggesting mode. There we go.
Yeah,
that's what I just did. There we go. All right.
Yeah.
This is an experiment. Experiment in podcasting. Okay, my undergrad GPA is currently a 3.95, and my graduate GPA, parentheses, which I don't think counts, end parentheses, is a 4.0. I have extremely ambitious legal career goals and hope one day to be a federal appellate judge, and this has been my goal ever since I started reading opinions and listening to oral arguments back in high school.
I don't care about any of this. I mean, maybe I want to know that you want to be a federal judge, but that is not a unique goal.
Well, I would keep the GPA. I don't care about the master's in history. You understand it doesn't count. So I don't think that there's any reason to mention that even.
Yeah.
As far as I have extremely ambitious legal career goals, I mean, all that has to go, right?
Absolutely. Just,
I mean, being a federal appellate judge, that is an extremely ambitious legal goal. Yes. So just say that. That's the fact. That's showing. The first part was telling. That's showing.
Yeah.
Showing always beats telling.
I don't care about the majors. I care about the fact that he's a junior in college because timeline is helpful sometimes. But I doubt me. It may not end up being important. So right now I'm cutting all this stuff except for GPA.
Okay. Yeah.
My undergrad GPA is currently 3.95 and my graduate, which I don't think counts, is gone. Doesn't matter.
Yeah. And all this is gone. This has been my goal ever since I started reading opinions and listening to oral arguments back in high school. Come on.
Okay.
All right. My target law schools are Harvard and Chicago. I think we can leave that. That's relevant.
Yeah. Although also. Okay. That's fine. Yeah. Go ahead.
I'm assuming that
he's going to go to all the top schools, right? Sorry.
Well, if you're going to be a federal appellate judge, but I guess specifically mentioning Harvard and Chicago, you know, those are two of the top three schools, or wait, one of the top three. Harvard's not in the top three anymore.
Yeah, number four.
Chicago is the top three. Anyway, stupid. I know that pretty much regardless of how well I score, I will have to pay a significant amount of money to go to these schools, but I feel that it's worth it considering my goals. Ultimately, that's neither here nor there right now, seeing as I don't have my target score, so I'm getting ahead of myself.
Bye.
This is from somebody who prefaced their email by saying, this email might be a bit long, but I think it's necessary. Then two paragraphs later, you're saying, you're literally using the words, that's neither here nor there. So,
and admitting that you're getting ahead of yourself. So what is this for?
It's just, you know, I mean, what you really could have said is, I didn't take the time to edit this email. Sorry that it's long.
Yep.
Anyway, I started studying for the LSAT in May 2022. I initially planned on taking the June LSAT, good grief, but held off until August, and I just took it in September as well. My target score was something in the low 170s, but I'd adjusted that to the high 170s. Cut that. Yep. Don't care. Tell me your damn August score. Like, why you just took the September LSAT? That means you have an August score. Why don't you tell me what your August score was? I don't give a shit what your goal was.
I don't care about the plans too.
No, not relevant, not unique, not relevant, not necessary.
Yep.
And we're not trying to beat you up, Anthony. Just taking you at your word. You know, you said you thought all this shit was necessary. It is not. I had the luxury of being able to take the summer off to focus exclusively on the LSAT, and I didn't let that opportunity go to waste. Still haven't heard the actual score. I spent a month doing Khan Academy prep and raised my score from my diagnostic of 153 to 169. Parentheses, raising my score there was due less to the quality of the prep and more to the volume of the questions I studied. Since then, I found the demon and haven't looked back. I love the podcast and I love the site. Over those couple months, I scored a 180, a few 177s, and a few times in the mid 170s range. So I felt set to take the test officially. Still don't know the August score.
Yep.
How much of that is going to be relevant? I guess we don't know yet. We have to see what questions Anthony's asking.
Well, I don't know that the journey is relevant.
It's like probably not.
This is relevant. Oh, you scored a 180. You scored a few 177. It's like, I like to know practice test scores because that's good, solid information about how you might do on the actual test.
August went extremely poorly, which is a conclusion. I mean, say the damn score.
Yeah.
I had some technical difficulties and freaked out, parentheses, not to mention strong test anxiety for my first time taking it, end parentheses. So I knew afterwards that I just wasn't even close to my target score. Stop having target scores. What are you doing? You need to play your game. Your game was really good. Having a target score in the high 170s was not helping your game. I mean, it prevents you from actually getting it done in the moment. If you have test anxiety and you have a target score, I can't tell you directly how to get rid of your test anxiety, but getting rid of your target score might help.
Absolutely.
I don't care what your target score was. I just care that you had a target score. I think that's a bad idea. All right. Maybe I should have canceled it, comma, I'm not sure. I got a 167. Do you want to address the cancellation issue?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. You don't need to worry about it.
Right. Doesn't matter. Cancellation and a bad score are the same thing. That's not the score that they're going to use to decide whether they're going to admit you. Luckily, I had signed up for the September test because I felt it would be wise to take them back to back before my classes really picked up. Took that one, felt okay, but not great. Got the 171 back a few days ago. I started this process early, quote, or parentheses, earlier than most, because applying next fall is important to me. The school is most important. The school is more important, most important, and I'm prepared to take a gap year if necessary, but next fall is a target for me, and the way I've staggered my studying should make that possible.
Targets, all these targets.
Yeah, what? I know. I mean, maybe it's actually necessary that Anthony put all this into the email, but what we're going to tell you, Anthony, is get rid of all this shit. Your LSAT game is strong. You've been scoring in the high 170s like all the time.
Yeah, I'm gonna get rid of the Khan Academy stuff. It's nice to know that Anthony's using the demon. I'm glad he likes the podcast and the site, but we don't need to know that.
Not if you're worried about the length. If you're apologizing about the length of your email, some stuff has to go.
What we're gonna see at the end with these kept sentences is an email that actually conveys your question faster and more effectively than more words.
Yeah.
Okay. I got a one. Yeah. You're going to delete that. Yeah. Delete that. I got a 167. I don't care about your luckiness.
Yeah. I don't really care how you felt. I mean, I care about the score.
Yeah. Got 177. Okay.
In September.
Yeah. I don't care when you started this process. I don't feel like the timeline here is important. I guess.
Well, it shouldn't be important, but now Anthony's asking the questions about the timelines, right?
Okay.
So we'll leave that. Yeah, maybe we have to leave it because here. So Anthony says, so here's my plan. This is the fifth paragraph. Anthony says, so here's my plan. I want to take it again in January. It'll be my last attempt for this cycle, but the timing would be better than September. And I shouldn't have tech difficulties or anxiety that I had before August. Also, I would be able to spend winter break really studying, which I haven't been able to do while being on campus, because right now keeping my grades up is the main focus. So with some time to decompress and some time to focus on full-time studying, January could be a great target. There's that word again.
Target, yeah.
If I fail to achieve my goal score there, I could buckle down next summer and focus on maybe the June and or August administrations. Then I would have had 5 chances and still applied on time, parentheses, consistent with my secondary goal of applying in the fall of 2023, which really should be your primary goal at this point in the cycle, Anthony. I mean, if you're going to follow our advice, the Thinking LSAT advice, the LSAT demon advice, you need to be applying at the beginning of the cycle. So are you really thinking you're going to take the January LSAT and then apply this cycle? That's a terrible plan. If you want to give yourself your best chance of admissions and your best chance of scholarships, by all means, take it in January if that's a good time for you, but don't apply until the fall of 2023.
I do want to talk about January. I mean, Anthony admits that he's in school. He said at the beginning, right, he's a junior.
Yep.
He's got so much time. Like if any of this is stressful, and it does sound like there might be some of that going on here, because he says, so with some time to decompress, right? Just follow our order of operations. Glad. Work on your grades first, then work on your LSAT, then apply, then decide whether you're going to go to law school. It's enjoy your life. Go live your life and do that by doing really well on grades. Then go do really well on the LSAT. Then apply. And then decide whether you still want to pursue this path. This all just sounds like stressful and anxiety inducing.
Yeah, you're having a hard time on your official tests because you're doing it in the most stressful possible way. Like, I guarantee that when you took it, for the first, you know, you started your studying in May of 2022 and then you already took it in August. Maybe you weren't quite ready for that attempt. Maybe that's why you had some issues. I understand you also had some technical difficulties and whatever. But the point, you know, you're underperforming your practice tests. So that's the thing that you really have to solve. Why am I underperforming my practice tests? And because you are trying to force in applications in a cycle that you have no business being in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you would have killed it in August, then fine. Or if you would have killed it in September, then fine. But you didn't. you know you're capable of way better. You got to just decide that the ship has sailed on this cycle, and you should be looking at taking it three more times before fall of 2023 and applying in fall of 2023. Take a gap year. You're stressing yourself out. You're wasting attempts because you're underperforming on those attempts because you're so stressed out about this process.
And you're a junior in college, but you're already working on an accelerated master's program so that you'll have a master's degree in 2024. Why? Do you need that master's degree in history to become a federal judge? You're just adding more stuff to your plate. You're like, hey, I'm going to go run in this race. Can you guys give me that backpack? I'm going to put that on and I'm going to run. Why? I don't understand.
If you're super interested in it, that's great. I hope you're excelling. I mean, you better be getting straight A's in that program.
He does have a 4.0 in his master's program.
What's the point of it? I don't know. If you're going to law school?
I mean, he's still in college. That's why it's like you're just adding to your plate of
stuff. Potentially hurting your undergraduate grades. Oh, you have a 3.95. That's great. But that's what matters, that master's. So, all right. Anthony continues, I mean, naturally, that depends on how far off I am. If I take the June test and still fall well short of my goals, then a gap year would likely be in order. Oh, because he's only a junior.
Yeah.
So if he, okay, so fall of 2023, maybe I was totally wrong about all that stuff earlier. He was not trying to apply this cycle at all.
Yeah.
Okay, I was wrong. My bad. I apologize. Fall of 2023 then is not your secondary goal. That's your,
secondary to his first goal of getting into these schools.
Great. Okay. So then he is thinking about it totally right, where he's like, I would love to apply in fall of 2023, but I know that I might not be ready. So I'm happy to take a gap year.
Yep.
Which he totally should be, but he also doesn't have to. He's already been prepping for the LSAT. Three more attempts between now and fall of 2023. It does seem like he could do it on that timeline if he wanted to.
Yes. Although I don't love this idea of like, I'm going to study during my winter break.
No, I don't love that either. Why?
That's a 2 week, 3 week, 4 week break at most, right? People make progress on the test when they do it consistently, civilly over time.
Yep.
I'd rather, like, if I could just, you know, swing a magic wand, Anthony, in your direction. I don't know why you're doing the master's degree. If you love it, then that's good. That's a reason to do it. But I'd rather replace your master's degree with time to focus on your current GPA, which is going to matter for your grades, for your law school applications and your LSAT score. Just like take this thing off your plate and focus on the two things that really matter. If your real goal is to become a federal judge, but maybe you have some other goals.
Yeah. Why do you need to, people don't get worse at the LSAT really. I mean, you've scored a 180, you've scored a few 177s, you've scored a few times in the mid 170s. You felt like you were ready to take it in August and September. It sure as hell seems like you were ready to take it based on all those practice test scores.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see why you're not going to be ready to take it whenever it is. You don't need to full-time study before your LSAT.
So the decompressing is decompressing from school, which is probably what led to maybe some of the anxiety.
He wants some time to focus on full-time studying for the LSAT, which we never even recommend.
Yeah.
Anthony then says, I really don't think it will take that, though. I have the logic in my head. I know I do. Between the 167 and 171 official tests, I took a practice test and got a 176. Wait, you only took one practice test in between your two official tests? I've sat down for 2.5 hours and gotten a 180 on a full-length practice test, so I know the potential is there, and I just have to live up to it. That sounds like Anthony's maybe doing four-section practice tests, 2.5 hours, right? Because the new, including an experimental section, 2.5 hours. All right, yeah, that makes sense. Anyway, how does my plan sound? I'm trying to use the advice I've gotten listening to your podcast and apply it to my situation, but after another disappointing score, I wanted to reach out and see if I'm still on the right track. All that can be deleted. I don't know if I've come to love the test, but I enjoy the games and I respect that the LSAT is doable, learnable, and designed well for what it's trying to test. Thank you so much for the Demon and for your podcasts. I don't know how I would have gotten even this far, despite how short of my goals I currently am. That's someone who's gotten a 180 on a practice test telling us how short they are of their goals.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot more of this stuff that we could probably cut. Point, I guess, that I was trying to make with this experiment is that like half of this, more than half of this email doesn't need to be here.
Yeah.
It's not necessary. Anyway, Anthony, thank you for writing in. I hope that we answered your questions. Ben, any final advice for Anthony?
Yeah, Anthony has the ability to do very well on this test. Some of this is just going to be variance taking the test multiple times, but I want this process for you, Anthony, to be something in which you're working on the test over time, right? You're studying for the test and you go take it. Maybe you go take it in November. Maybe you go take it in December. I don't want this whole ramp up over your winter break and then you take it. Don't change what you're doing. You're doing well on the practice test. You need to mitigate the stress that's coming from the rest of your life. And I don't know the best way for you to do that, but it seems like you have a lot on your plate.
It seems like you're taking, I'm going to stop my share there. I think that's enough editing, live editing. I don't know if that even worked for the listeners. Point. Yeah. I think you're treating the official tests differently from how you're treating your practice tests. You're killing all your practice tests, but then you're giving the official test way too much respect. And I think that's the thing that you should really be focusing on instead of focusing all this energy on what happens if I don't do or don't reach my goal by this particular date. It's like, stop being so focused. You're like attached to those official test administrations when you need to be really just kind of treating them a little more casually, like your practice tests.
Yeah. If you just strolled in and took November, how would that go?
Oh, it seems like this guy would kill it. He says he knows he has the logic in his brain. I totally believe you 1,000%.
Yeah.
Like I would bet money on you if you don't do a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
And this idea that you're going to focus on full-time studying in January, I would rather bet on you for November.
Yeah. If you can get these other things, like if you can get the right mindset and somehow stop letting all these plans sort of clutter your thinking.
If you can't get it done, then you just shouldn't be doing LSAT while you're also doing not only undergrad, but also a master's program.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's just not the right time for you. If you're having that much, you know, you're having these performance problems, maybe you're just doing too much.
Anthony is someone who has really high goals, right? Because anyone else accomplishing these two things at the same time with a 3.95 and a 4.0 would be considered killing it.
Yet Anthony is telling us again how short of his goals he currently is.
Yeah.
He's having self-induced performance anxiety on the exams. That's something that I have never been subject to. I've never experienced that at all because I've never given a shit. You need a little bit of that. Fuck it, Anthony. You need to be like, no, I know how to do this test. I'm going to kill it. I don't care when you want to test me. I'm ready. Bring it.
Yep.
A little bit of that kind of swagger instead of like, can you imagine, Ben, you know, having 180s on your practice record, but then still thinking that you need to study full time before you take the official test?
Yeah.
That's your problem, Anthony.
Here we have an email from Anonymous.
Hi, Ben and Nathan. I've been with the Demon since August and took the September exam. Despite sustaining an injury that hindered my test-taking ability 2 weeks before the test administration deadline and severe test anxiety that left me with only 4.5 hours of sleep the night prior, I scored a 167, which was 1 point lower than my highest practice test score. Okay. That's great. 1 point lower than your highest PT. That's awesome. Even though you had anxiety and bad sleep and an injury.
Yeah. What's the problem? I'm ready.
Yeah. For context, my diagnostic was a 152. I studied with Kaplan, and then in parentheses, anonymous writes, terrible, for 4 months, and then in parentheses, mistake, before taking the October 2021 test and scoring a 159, which was only 7 points higher than my diagnostic. So 4 months of grinding it out and only getting 7 points, that's not fun at all. In roughly one third of the time with the demon, my score increased by 8 points with suboptimal test conditions included. Great. Glad it clicked for you. My section layout for September 2022 was logic games, which was scored, reading comp, logical reasoning, logic games, which was experimental. I completely blundered the setup for the third game in the first section, and I am certain that I missed at least 3 to 4 questions on this game alone. I realized this while checking my answers during the test. Checking answers during the test? You didn't learn that at the demon. I mean, we don't do that. Why would you need to check your answers? Like, you solve the questions before you select an answer. So ain't no checking answers in our world. My practice test games average is roughly minus zero. This made it unlikely that I could perform as well as I had on my PTs, and I knew this only one section in. That's bad times. You should stop checking your answers. Like, you're the checking your answers there, whatever that means. I mean, that's so weird. How do you know you missed those questions? Bizarre. I don't know how that would possibly be the case, but anyway, I knew this only one section in. Yeah, well, that's bad times, because then that can really infect your performance on the other two sections that are scored. So it's really bad to have that going on. Anyway, but I could not quit, says Anonymous. I had a dream, really an epiphany, two nights before. I was an old man living in a house on the beach. In my dream, as the sun rose each day, I would walk along the shore with my wife collecting seashells before work. We assembled quite an assortment of beautiful shells of all shapes, sizes, and colors. It was the week of the seashell fair in my dream. So naturally, rather than spending our morning collecting shells, we decided to arrange them as they were to be displayed at the fair. We left for work, leaving the shells outside. Uh-oh. Then disaster struck. Sideways and torrential rain, hurricane gusts. As I returned from work, our cherished collection was decimated. It was an irreparable tragedy, so I thought. My wife then delivers the most valuable sliver of advice, wisdom that was ultimately applied to the LSAT as I sat with my head in my hands, staring blankly at the first reading comprehension passage, knowing full well I had just bombed my best section of the test.
Oh my gosh.
Quote, "Don't count the shells that you lost. Go find more," she says. So we step outside and begin collecting shells. As it turned out, many of the seashells lost in the storm settled in the dunes and weren't too far away. Even better, the swell from the storm brought in new shells, shells I never would have found if I gave up on my shell collection. Our collection was even better than before on the day of the fair, and we ended up winning first prize. Yay.
Okay.
That's exactly what I did on the LSAT. Even with between -3 and -4 on logic games, I maintained focus through the final three sections. I didn't, quote, count the shells I had lost. I went out and picked out all the shells I could find. This dream was unquestionably a manifestation of one of the many helpful demon theses. Answer one question at a time. You cannot change past mistakes, and be where your feet are. These tenets saved my LSAT. Any thoughts, Ben? He's just kind of sitting there smirking.
I'm glad that these tenets helped you, but I'm still kind of caught up in the, you were grading yourself and you knew you had -3, -4 on games. In that sense, you're not counting, or you're not counting the shells you lost. You're going back and figuring out what they are. What did I miss? What did I get right? So I'm a little confused with that, but okay.
I agree that strategically you need to stop that first step of looking, going back and checking and then realizing that you fucked up. Like, you should have gone slower in the first place and not done those fuck ups. And then you shouldn't be going back. I mean, on my official test, I finished the games in 20 minutes and I didn't even do anything for the next 15 minutes. Like, I knew that they were right. So I didn't have to go back and check. There ain't no double checking. Like, I had solved those questions. And that's really where you're going. So that you're missing one demon tenet at that point. But it does. I get it. I understand that you recovered nicely. That's awesome. All right. Last paragraph. I'm registered for October. I have had less time to study as I have recently started a new job. Still, the skills are there, and I'm confident that I can score higher than 167, especially since we can assume that October test conditions will be more favorable than September's. I hate to burst your bubble, but you did score on the high end of your practice test range. So you're complaining about the test conditions, but they apparently didn't hurt you.
Yeah.
I don't know that I would be so confident based on what you've told us so far. I don't think you should be so confident that you're automatically going to score higher than 167.
I hope you do, and I hope you bring your practice test score range up before that test, but without doing that, chances are you might actually go down.
Yeah, you do need to prep. I mean, ideally, you're going to walk into that October test with a range that is higher than 167. If your range is higher than 167, then I would bet on you to score higher than 167. But if 167 is still near the top of your range, then I would actually bet on you to score lower than 167. Anonymous continues, even if I score much lower, I can cancel with score preview. Regardless, it's incredibly comforting knowing that schools only evaluate applicants using the applicant's highest score. My stress level entering the exam should be very low as a result. Thank you to the whole Demon Team, Anonymous.
Good luck. Keep pushing up that practice test score average.
Relatively new Demon student. And I do think you've picked up a lot of what we have to say. But couple things I think you've missed. I mean, you do need to get that practice test range higher than 167 if you really are a good bet to score higher than 167. Score preview, we wouldn't waste money on, because schools only care about your highest score, and we don't take the test unless we are a good bet to score higher. So get your practice test range up. Don't even bother with score preview. Take it again, and then potentially again after that, and you know, whatever. You got multiple bites at it, so don't worry about score preview.
We have an email here from Anonymous.
It says, hi, Nathan and Ben. I'm currently scheduled to take the October LSAT. By the way, that's coming up. October LSAT, October 14th and 15th.
2022.
Yep. Prior to the August test, I had been averaging above a 175 with multiple scores of 180. But when I actually took it, I got awful test anxiety and absolutely froze on reading comprehension. I ended up with a 170, and since then, I have put a lot of work into reading comprehension on the demon. I hadn't had any help prior to my attempt besides the LSAT trainer, and have found that your approach to reading comp is not only more accurate and faster than just scanning the passage and rushing to find answers, but also helps me feel more confident in my answers, which, no shit, because you are not going to feel confident in your answers if you're doing any kind of skim hunt for the answer type of a strategy.
I don't know the LSAT trainer, but if that's the advice that they're giving, I mean, this correspondent could be confused, but if that's the advice that that book is giving, I would be deeply concerned.
Yeah. I think this new approach of actually reading it and actually understanding it will help me feel more in control and less anxious while taking the actual test. Thank you for all that you do! Exclamation point. You're welcome, Anonymous. The problem is that I was really hoping to apply to law school in September. I have a 3.93 UGPA. So I felt that if I was able to score above a 175, like I had been on my practice tests, that I would be competitive for some of the top schools in the country. Now, however, at the earliest I will be able to apply is November 2nd, the day of the October LSAT score release, which, yeah, is coming up here. If I do score in my target range, ideally a 177 or above, which should be possible considering my practice scores, does it make sense to apply in early November? I know it's best to apply in September, but I'm already in my second gap year out of college. If I were to hold off on applying until next year, I would basically spend the next year of my life just waiting to apply to law school, and the year after that, just waiting to go to law school. I would love to go travel around Europe or something, but I don't have that kind of money. Oh, it doesn't cost that much money, though. I will basically just be sitting on my ass, working a job I like but don't love, and waiting. I want to be as competitive an applicant as possible, but also don't want to waste the next 2 years of my life. What do you think I should do? Thank you, Anonymous.
So there are some schools that don't consider applications or don't review them until January, right? A few? Yale?
Just no. Well, I mean, Yale, it just opened.
Okay.
So they're open. I just don't think you can compromise being as competitive an applicant as possible with anything else. I think you need to be as competitive an applicant as possible. We just read on the Thinking LSAT podcast, we just read that email from Victor. You know, Victor applied on the first day with his 171 to the University of Texas, and in a couple, and that's a top 14 school. And in a couple weeks, he said he had gotten his almost full ride scholarship offer.
So the real problem here is that although some schools might not review applications until November, December, January, there are definitely going to be some schools you're applying to in the top 14 that will be, and you're putting yourself at a disadvantage there. And if you're getting less money there or whatever, then you're not going to be as competitive for the cycle. All this is speculative though, right? We need to get that score first. So maybe none of this is going to even matter. Maybe you take the October test, you don't get that 177, you get a 172, you know you're much better at the test than that, so you have to take it again in November or January or whatever, and none of this is going to matter.
Yeah, it's totally true that Anonymous is crossing a bridge that he or she has not come to yet. And so, you know, you really should just be talking to us when that score comes back. But you're also just, you know, it's human nature, but you're thinking about sunk costs, and that is not helpful, right? I mean, he's worried, or he or she is worried about, I would be wasting the next 2 years of my life. Well, you're already wasting the next 1 year of your life. So it's not 2 years that we're even talking about. What we're talking about is one more year.
And let's question the assumption that it's being wasted. It's only wasted if you don't use it. You're going to be living. You're either going to be living in law school or you're going to be living outside of law school. Time will pass regardless. There's this assumption here that unless that time is being passed in law school, it somehow is not being used. What?
Yeah, it's just that it's the hustle culture, you know? It's like fucking America with everybody just like pursuing money and career at all costs and not living their life.
And meet somebody.
They say, I would love to go travel around Europe or something, but I don't have that kind of money. There's lots of places where you can travel for cheap. If you're
super cheap. Yeah, there's blogs dedicated to traveling with a backpack and figuring out how to make it work.
Yeah, and maybe you're not going to be, you know, doing that. Well, no, there's hostels in London. There's hostels in Paris. There's places even in the big cities that you can go for cheap. And maybe you can change your job if you like your job. Can you do it remote?
That would be awesome.
That would be awesome, is to go digital nomad for a couple of years while you wait for your law school shit to be sorted out. But, you know, let's say you do get this 177 and you have the 3.93 UGPA, which is great. I don't want you to make your 177/3.93 sad. And I think that's what you're going to do if you apply in the middle of the cycle instead of applying at the beginning of the cycle. I just see no reason why not to wait a few more months. You're making it out to be this huge thing of 2 years of my life and I'm wasting my life. But no, it's actually just waiting. By the time the November score comes out, you know, you're really only waiting until August of the next year. Because some applications do open in August. So you're talking about waiting 9 months to apply.
You're also putting pressure on yourself to really knock it out of the park in October. Totally. And so that decreases your likelihood of even doing that.
This plan is bad for your October score. Yes. To be clear. You should be planning on taking the October test and the November test and then applying next cycle.
We have an email here from Quentin.
It's a very thoughtful email from Quentin. It's a follow-up to our discussion that we had on an episode a week or two ago about, remember, Ben, when the Egyptian guy was asking about whether he should check the box for African-American? And we naively said, well, Egypt is in Africa and you identify, you know, I mean, you're not white and
yeah,
Egypt is yeah. in Africa and you're an American now. So why not African-American?
Sure.
I think the reason why we said, you know, the reason why that was our answer was because I think the schools necessarily have to defer to the applicant on a lot of these issues. You know, what is your identity?
Yep.
And also because lawyers are driven by facts. And if a lawyer can, you know, if you can say Egypt is in Africa, I'm black living in America, you asked me my ethnicity and I said African-American. Like it's a very
literal
simple
definition. Yeah.
Right. And so, but the thing, I guess I want to point out that there is a difference between like, and there's a difference between truth and justice. Right. Okay. Or like, there's a difference between defensible facts and what would actually be just or fair.
Or what the goal, the underlying goal is.
The goal of the policy. And
yeah, the spirit of the law and the letter of the law.
You have to recognize that we're not really looking at the spirit of the law. We're looking at the letter of the law. Like what would be a defensible position for someone to take?
Which is kind of the definition of the legal profession, but yeah, okay.
Well, that's what you'll learn, unfortunately, when you go to law school. You're going to realize how amoral this entire thing is. I mean, it's just like, it's not about right and wrong. It's about what are we allowed to do. And anyway, Quentin has a much more nuanced and resourced take on this whole thing. And so I'm going to read Quentin's email top to bottom, because this is a much more thorough treatment of this topic. Okay. My name is Quentin, and I've been listening to the Demon Daily podcast for several months. In the recent episode titled, Am I African American? I felt like the ethnic designation of African American and what it means was misrepresented and misunderstood by both of you, so I want to provide some clarity. African American is an ethnic group that exclusively encompasses individuals who descend from U.S. chattel slavery. It has nothing to do with racialized features such as dark skin or kinky hair. It does have to do with country of origin to the extent that one can trace their ancestry back to U.S. chattel slavery. So I'm not endorsing this view, by the way. This is all news to me. Quentin seems to know what he's talking about. But I don't know what the authority is for any of those assertions, right? Like, wait, you have to be able to track yourself back to U.S. chattel slavery in order to be an African American? I'm not saying you're wrong. I just don't know why you're right. I believe you. It seems like you're earnest. But why, I guess. Second paragraph. Currently, there is a growing identity debate in Black America. Before 1965, Black people of foreign birth residing in the United States were nearly invisible. According to the 1960 census, their percentage of the population was to the right of the decimal point. That, however, is no longer the case. At the beginning of this year, the Pew Research Center found that Black immigrants and their U.S.-born children account for 21% of the overall Black population. Though Black immigrants and African Americans are all a part of the Black race, our lineal experiences are worlds apart. What does lineal mean? Like having something
lineage?
To do with lineage? Yeah.
I'm assuming lineage, yeah.
Define lineal. It's an adjective in a direct line of descent or ancestry. Okay. So, yeah, okay, I get it. You obviously have different ancestors. The most glaring and perhaps consequential difference is that nearly all Black immigrants migrated to a post-civil rights America when overt discrimination had decreased and opportunities were expanding for women and minorities. African Americans, on the other hand, were here pre-civil rights and are still dealing with the legacies of slavery and the Jim Crow era when they were effectively locked out of making political and economic gains. In fact, the sustained multi-generational plunder of African Americans has resulted in an egregious black-white wealth gap. Not sharing this pre-1965 history that African Americans experienced made it possible for some groups of black immigrants to achieve greater social and economic status than African Americans. African Americans as defined by Quentin. And of course, we totally get it, right? Like Egypt, well, there's a lot of money in some places in Egypt. And if you weren't being discriminated against for being black in Egypt, your ancestors, that is, then I can certainly see why your black experience as an Egyptian immigrant to the United States could be dramatically different from somebody whose, you know, great grandparents were slaves, obviously. So we can see why there's a debate, right, Ben? One of the measures being advocated for in the midst of America's changing black demographic is the disaggregation of blackness. Proponents argue that lumping all people of African descent together does more harm than good. Take, for example, college admissions, particularly to elite universities. According to some accounts, over 40% of black students who attend Ivy League institutions are black immigrants or the children of black immigrants. Aside from masking the failure of African American students to rise to the top levels of America's educational system, using African American as a catch-all is also unfair. Black immigrants are self-selected based on factors such as educational attainment and wealth. Thus, when black immigrants arrive in the U.S., they have certain advantages at the aggregate level over African Americans and sometimes white Americans. For example, in 2019, 64% of black Nigerian immigrants residing in the U.S. had at least a bachelor's degree, compared to an estimated 22% of African Americans and 36% of non-Hispanic white Americans. In Nigeria, however, only 7% of the population had earned a bachelor's degree, making African Americans compete with people who are, in many cases, the elite of their respective countries of origin based on similarities in phenotype, misses a lot of crucial nuances, like the fact that at his 1964 commencement speech at Howard University, President Lyndon B. Johnson was very clear about who affirmative action was intended to help. And there's links throughout this. I can't really convey that very well in a podcast, but there's links to many of these. That's pretty striking, huh? Like 7% of Nigerians have a bachelor's, but 64% of black Nigerian immigrants to the U.S. have bachelor's.
Yeah, it's a surprising fact to learn, but once you learn it, it makes some sense.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
People who are leaving their country of origin are people who have access to means, education, whatever.
Although counter argument, you know, you got people like walking to the United States from Guatemala. They're not doing that because they have riches and opportunities. They're doing that because they have the exact opposite of riches and opportunities. And,
true.
You know,
but so, in general, I would say when people have means, they also have mobility, right?
Yes.
In a way that if you don't have means, it's going to be harder to move or even know your options, right?
Yes. But there are plenty of displaced people, refugees who have nothing and are it's because they are displaced. That's why they're mobile. Like they don't have anywhere else to be. So there's got, and like, it's gotta be some of both, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Quentin continues, while I don't have a lot of knowledge about how race and ethnicity work in Egypt, I do know that first generation black immigrants, especially those from Africa and the Caribbean, don't know that they are black until they come to the United States. In fact, last week, my coworker, who is a Ugandan immigrant with dark brown skin, told me during lunch that there is no need to refer to oneself as black in Uganda. Even when they do understand the various racial categories in the U.S., African and Caribbean immigrants do not identify with black or African American. Instead, they check the, quote, some other race box and write in their respective ethnicity or nation of origin, which is what I would have told the anonymous listener from Egypt to do. I hope my response was illuminating, or at the very least, you now understand that being African American is vastly different from being an African in America. If you have questions, comments, or are curious about anything I've written, feel free to email me. Thanks, Quentin. Thank you, Quentin. That was definitely illuminating. Obviously, I don't think there's an easy answer to this question.
No, it's a very, yeah, challenging race itself is a, it's a complex mix of all sorts of cross currents. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, next time somebody asks me this question, I'm just going to forward them Quentin's email, but I don't think I would go straight to, oh, you have to check some other race and write in your exact nation of origin, because I think I'm still going to go back to, well, it's up to you. Like, what do you identify as?
Yeah.
I, you know, all this identity stuff. I don't know. I'm a dumb white guy. I'm not the guy who's supposed to have answers to any of this stuff. So I don't know. I kind of think it's going to have to come back to, like, how do you feel about checking that box? If they were to ask you about checking that box, what would you say? And I don't know. I fully willing to grant that that might be wildly unfair in some cases, but it ain't fair. Like, none of this is fair. Anyway, really appreciate your email, Quentin. Thank you for the clarification on that. Hey there, welcome to LSAT Demon Daily. I'm Nathan Fox. With me is Brandon Beaver. I am one of the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and our weekly podcast, Thinking LSAT. Brandon is a former LSAT Demon student and current LSAT Demon teacher. How you doing, Brandon?
I'm great, Nate. How you doing today?
Excellent, except for a bear broke into my car overnight and ripped open my center console and also ripped a hole in my golf bag. But other than that, I'm doing just fine. We have an email here from Mitch. Why don't you read it for us, Brandon?
Yeah, will do. All right. It says, Dear Ben and Nathan, my question today is personal statement and addendum related. All right, cool. Between 20 plus hour work weeks out of necessity, documented mental health / chemical dependency issues, and taking forever to realize that my initial STEM major was not for me, my undergrad career was mediocre. Well, one piece of advice, use a period, Mitch. That was a long sentence, my dude. If you're looking for personal statement advice. Let's carry on here. I was even dismissed for grades in my fourth year before re-entering and graduating as an English major, which provided a slight upswing. I'm assuming he means to his GPA.
Yeah.
Yeah, you pump the brakes there, unpack that one a little bit.
I don't think I would probably share very much of that stuff. Like, you have bad grades. Okay. I would never, ever talk about your mental health / chemical dependency issues unless you absolutely had to, like, because you had an arrest or something that you had to, like, disclose. I just don't think it's in your favor at all to talk about that. The next thing I would say is you got way too many excuses all in one thing here. You know, what was it? Was it the 20-hour work weeks, or was it the documented mental health issues, or was it the chemical dependency issues, or was it that the initial STEM major was not for you? You got to pick one. It can't be all four of those things. Now, I understand that in real life, it probably is a combination of all four of those things, but nobody wants to hear a litany of excuses. So, and I realize you're just writing into a podcast. You're not, like, doing that in a personal statement, but just don't come anywhere close to doing that in a personal statement, please.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think, like, that started strong. I worked 20 hours a week out of necessity. Well, great. Like, having just submitted applications, they love hearing about that kind of stuff. But then the rest of this is just, like, CNF crazy. You know what I mean? Like, this is just character and fitness things that you're going to have to address, Mitch. And you're going to need some pretty decent explanations. I mean, there's a lot of issues going on here.
Yeah, maybe. So, maybe. I mean, you could have had mental health issues that you don't need to disclose. You could have had chemical dependency issues that you don't need to disclose. The irresponsible thing of, like, having a major that wasn't right for you and then changing your mind. That's just shit that happens for kids. It's real common and it's not really a feather in your cap. So if you were explaining, if someone asks, like, why did you have bad grades? You say, well, I had to work 20 plus hours a week to pay the bills.
Yeah.
And that's only a partial explanation. That's okay. We don't need the full explanation. Give us the part of the explanation that makes you look good.
Yeah. When I say CNF, I'm mostly looking at that. I was even dismissed for grades in my fourth year.
Like,
they're going to see that and they're going to want to hear about it. They're going to want you to explain that for sure.
Yeah. You are going to have to explain that. But again, I think I would just say, you know, I was working 20 hours a week. I just couldn't get it done. I had to sort out some stuff in my, I had to sort out my financial situation when I came back, and then I killed it. Or, well, you didn't kill it. You had a slight upswing. I don't know. Okay. So anyway, you got a bad undergraduate record. Fine.
Yep. Let's keep moving here. It says, Mitch says, I subsequently served a stint in AmeriCorps. I then bartended professionally for 5 years while partially completing a post-baccalaureate certificate in writing before I realized that an MFA in creative writing or MA in journalism wasn't what I wanted, even though my grades were almost a 4.0. Man, Mitch, sounds to me like you're not really sure what you want to be doing, and that kind of scares me a little bit for you for your law career. I'll be honest with you, but I'm interested to hear what you have to say, Nate.
Well, it's okay to change your mind a million times. It's just that, like, when you're telling your story, if you're telling your story to people who are gonna, you know, be admitting you or not admitting you to school, I don't think that, like, it's a real common thing that people love to talk about what wasn't what I wanted. You know, like, well, I did this and that wasn't for me, and then I did this other thing and that wasn't the right fit. Yeah, okay. Well, then why are you talking about it? Like, you know, we don't go around like talking about our ex-girlfriends and or boyfriends that much, right? They weren't for us. We moved on. You're happily married now? Great. Okay. Well, then I don't really need to hear stories about all the ones that didn't work out. I don't know. It's just, or like, if you're on a, actually a better analogy is, you're on a date with a prospective partner, and you're going on and, well, that she didn't work out because she did this, and that didn't work out because that wasn't the right fit. It's like, whoa, okay. I mean, I get it that, you know, Mitch is just giving us some background for the show, but I don't think any of this probably really needs to make it into the law school's ears.
Yeah. Let's keep moving here. It says, after my bartending career was halted with the pandemic, I was inspired after many long conversations with a law student friend to get certified as a paralegal. I did that, getting a 4.0 in my program, and started working as a paralegal, which I love. I got a 162 on my LSAT in August, but know I can do better, so I'm retaking it later this week. I'm smart, stay hungry. That's just good advice in our opinion. You know, we want you to be prepared to take the test multiple times. And I mean, I think a 162 is a decent score, but I see no reason, assuming that you're drinking the Kool-Aid, Mitch. We see students all the time eclipsing 170 and then some after doing this well on an official test. So in my opinion, stay hungry.
Oh, on the Thinking LSAT podcast, we just had an email from somebody who scored 174, but thought they could score higher. And Ben and I both were just like, oh, absolutely. Take it again. Like, you're crazy not to. So 162, there's lots of room to score higher than that. And if you know you can do better, then I believe you. So yeah, keep taking it until you get that score that really represents your true ability.
With all of that, how much space in my personal statement should I give to each of those paragraphs? I feel, probably not a lot, Mitch. To take the words out of Nate's mouth there, I think. I feel like they show distinctive stages of my life: shaky young student, hardworking but aimless drifter, revitalized paralegal. But I don't want to tell my life story and forget to show why I want to go to law school. Thank you for reading this novel. Well, I love that. I love that salutation at the end there, just because self-awareness. But
you're missing, I mean, you're just, Mitch, you're missing a big point here, which is, I don't think you understand the purpose of the personal statement. The purpose of the personal statement is to sell yourself to law schools. I mean, whatever they say the purpose of the personal statement is, I don't give a shit. Your purpose in your personal statement is to sell yourself to the law schools. They're going to read this document. You've got, you know, this is your 5-minute meeting with the decision maker. What are you going to say to them in that 5 minutes that's going to get them to admit you? And this life story, going through the distinctive stages of your life, I would cut all of it except for the, you know, I don't know that I would say revitalized paralegal. You sound like a kick-ass paralegal. I mean, you're getting a 4.0 in your paralegal program. You love working as a paralegal. I think you should spend the entire 2 pages talking about how much you're kicking ass as a paralegal, because you know, that shaky young student is not what they're looking for. The hardworking but aimless drifter is also definitely not what they're looking for. But a successful paralegal is exactly what they're looking for. Like someone who has worked in law successfully and loves it. So you know what you're getting yourself into and you actually want to do that. Well, all you got to do is talk about that. The why I want to go to law school, I don't give one shit about that. Like, who cares? You don't even know what opportunities exist until you go to law school. You're going to change your mind in law school on what you want to do with your legal career. Okay. Almost everyone does. So I'm not interested. I don't law schools, you know, I think law schools give bad advice on personal statements. They say, oh, that's great. Tell us why you want to be a lawyer, you know, but I think all they're really saying is, we just want you to apply. We want you to write an app. We want you to write your personal statement. We want you to feel good about it. We want you to submit it so that we can decide whether we're going to admit you or not. And so, sure, they'll tell you, oh, you argued, really? You argued with your parents about your bedtime? Oh, that's perfect. Like, you just write about that, you know? And it's like, well, okay, you and half the other applicants are doing some bogus thing like that. And it's not where I would go if I was really making a sales pitch. You just don't differentiate yourself with stuff like that. Nor do you differentiate yourself with, like, I care deeply about the plight of refugees, or I care deeply about the plight of women, or I care deeply about the plight of whatever. Everybody cares deeply about those things. And you're just, it's not like, what are you bringing to the table? They're here to learn about you as a winner. Reasonable minds can disagree on this, and you're going to hear all kinds of different personal statement advice from different advisors. But I would say you put your best foot forward by showing yourself succeeding in things. And it looks here like what you have succeeded at is being a paralegal, which is the most appropriate thing you possibly could be successful at in order to convince them that you're going to be successful in law school. So I would spend 100% of the personal statement talking about that. Some of this other stuff you're going to have to maybe disclose to answer individual questions, but your personal statement needs to be a sales pitch for you and the troubles that you went through, losing your job due to COVID, doing masters, but not wanting to complete it. None of those things are good. They're real. But you're not scoring points. So I would just use the page and a half that you have here to score points by talking about how much you love being a paralegal and your paralegal program. Anything to add to that, Brandon?
Just as somebody who spent a lot of time working on a personal statement very, very recently, I echo all of this very strongly. I think that when I was crafting mine, I've hired and fired a lot of people. I've been in jobs and positions where that's been a big part of what I have to do. So I kind of treated it like the first step in the door of working my way into like an interview. You know, if I was kind of interviewing for this, so to speak, I know some schools do interviews, but how would I introduce myself? What would I try to say to let that prospective employer know I'm the right person for the job? And I'm not going to introduce anything that could be interpreted against me, whether or not in my interpretation of those events, it came out to be a net positive. Like, my interpretation of events is more or less irrelevant here. I'm submitting information to somebody who does not know me, who I have to exclusively get to believe that I'm worth the job. I'm worth the, in this case, admittance. I don't buy the narrative of like, Tell us the big thing that you overcame. I don't want to hear about the negative shit at all. Just like, introduce me to all of your strongest qualities. Introduce me to the things that are going to make it abundantly obvious that you're going to be a kick-ass lawyer and represent my school really well. That's going to attract future students, future classes of other people that look, sound, and behave like you to come here. And basically everything you introduced in that first paragraph, Mitch, I'd be very, very careful. You're already going to have to submit some CNF stuff. You will have to. Most schools are going to require it. Every one of them that I applied to had those boxes to check. And I mean, if you got dismissed for grades, you're going to have some explaining to do. I would not touch that at all in your personal statement. You're going to have an opportunity. Trust me.
No, the personal statement is not your life story, and it's not the place to disclose things that are bad for your application. The personal statement is it's your elevator pitch. It's your sales pitch for like why you're going to kick ass in the legal field. I just can't imagine including any of this stuff except for the winning part in your personal statement. Email daily at lsatdemon.com if you'd like to ask us a question or share some LSAT or law school admissions news. Thanks for listening.